to do was to try and break this into 2 weeks. And the idea would be that this evening we try and discuss some of the things that are in the spiritual background of the concept of marriage, from a mystical point of view, as well as perhaps some practical things, and try next week to speak about the more intimate side, as far as we're able to, breaking into men and women separately. So the men will meet together, and Mrs. Bloch, who's a particular expert at this subject, and also at giving it over, will speak to the women. So the questions that you have, and the very practical and especially the more intimate side, save until next week, and let's try and gain some insight into the background this evening. It's probably not a more important subject than this. It's obvious to anybody who's sensitive at all, and Chazal say it in many different ways, that if your marriage is a wreck, then you're a wreck. That means it's much more important what happens between you and that one person that you've chosen to commit yourself to than what the Prime Minister does, or the Chief Rabbi, or very little else in the world, no matter how big a disaster it could turn out to be, could be as significant as a very small fracture between those two parties. And it's the thing we do worst. In this generation, it's probably the thing we do worst. It's the place we're supposed to draw our power from. It's the place where spiritual growth begins. It's the place where normal stability begins, what makes a person a mensch. Just a normal, basic, stable approach to begin living begins in a marriage relationship, and that's what we do worst. Most marriages aren't surviving today. In a good, old-fashioned, conservative community like Johannesburg, the divorce rate is quoted now as being more than 1 in 2. It's probably accurate, that figure. There are places where it's much higher than that. And those who are not yet divorced doesn't always mean that the marriages are happy. A vast minority of cases of those who haven't gotten divorced, the marriage, the spark has gone out of it long ago. Which means that the spark's gone out of life. Let's try and understand where the mistake comes in, what are the mistakes, why we do it so badly, and how we can take home some message. Perhaps spiritually the background, these are very difficult things to talk about, but the spiritual background is something like this. There are things in the creation of the world that occur at different stages. In other words, when a child is formed, first of all you have an event that happens around the formation of the genes of the child. The cell, the nucleus of the child is formed, and that's when the genes are being put together. Then the cell starts to multiply. Then the child starts to develop. Finally he's born, and he gets older. There's a whole process in the full development of any entity in the world. Marriage is something that connects with the genes of the world. That means if you want to trace how the world functions, and you want to trace it back in spiritual cause and effect, so there are many issues in the world that take place at different strata, different levels of the whole development process. Marriage is an idea that takes place in the conception of the universe. That means that the highest mystical secrets, the deepest mystical secrets, are contained in the idea of marriage, and it's one reason, incidentally, why women cannot learn Kabbalah. There's no way a woman can learn the mystical wisdom, the Kabbalistic wisdom, unless it's with a father or a husband. Because to learn with anybody else, the intimacy is so great. But if you happen to have a Kabbalistic streak in you, and you're female, you better send your husband to learn. Because it's the only way you can have access to the information. But to learn it with a man who's not your husband, there's no way to enter this arena, because the sensitivity and the intimacy is so intense in that area that even for people who are correctly prepared, it's a great danger. But unprepared, it's impossible. So we're talking about something that's of nuclear power, like in every sense, in its potency. The first thing that happened when the world was created, let's try and trace it back in a few steps and understand this idea. The first thing that happened, one of the first things that happened, was that man and woman were created. Let's look at that for a moment. You'll see it goes back beyond that. But let's look at that. The creation of man and woman was an explosive event. It didn't look anything like we picture it today. For example, it says that Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, Adam Arishon and Chava, were created as one being. Right? They had no back. One face was male and one face was female. There was no back to that dual being. They were bodily joined together. For certain reasons, also difficult, the intimate side is very difficult to go into in detail, but because of certain events that happened, they saw the animals, behaving in a certain way, male and female. So they asked to be separated to be able to have that experience. Again, a lot of this is just have to see beyond the hint. But they asked to be separated in order to be able to share that experience. It's a deep idea what that means. But in superficial terms, that's what happened. It says that Hashem tore them apart, God split them, ripped them apart physically, bodily, leaving each one with a back. That was when a back was created, right, in physical terms. The side that's negative, in mystical terms, again, it's the side where excretion takes place, it's the blind side. And they were brought face to face and given the job of getting back into one again. That means they were created as one, and they were given the job of forming one again, but through their own effort, as opposed to having been given it as a gift. Many, many ideas that are contained in this. One is the idea that it says that a person seeks marriage. It says that a man, for example, looks for a woman because he's lost something. When a man finds a woman, it says that he finds his own completion. Woman isn't like that. It says that in mystical terms, a woman is complete already. This is another idea we have to discuss sometime, and that is how the secular world misrepresents and misunderstands the mystical and Jewish view. They think that women are some kind of second-class citizen or baby factories pushed into a kitchen or something. Okay, that's what they describe it, but it's not correct. The spiritual power of the world, the place of completeness in the world, is where a woman is, what a woman is. It's also the place of power, incidentally. We have to talk about this separately sometime. The word kala, kala, which is a bride in Hebrew, is from the root kol, which means totality, finished, being complete. Right? It says that Berach is Abraham bakol, right? Hashem blessed Abraham with everything. Right? What does it mean, everything? It's talking about a wife. Gav Yitzchak, a wife. Because a man's not called anything. There was a Hasidic Rebbe in Jerusalem. He used to give his students apples. The unmarried ones used to give half an apple. Try and indicate to them the fact that. So a man has a deep sense of need, and it's a sense, the mystics say, of having lost something, and he has to mechazer achara. That means he has to constantly search for it, seek it, and then when he finds a woman, he finds his completeness. So that was the desire that was put into the human at the time when they were torn into two separate beings. Of course, there's another mystical idea in it as well, which is that you once had the experience of being one. That means a person, the highest pinnacle of ecstasy, of being able to bond with another human being, that a person could achieve in marriage, is something of a hint, a faint smell, faint hint, of what that experience once was when there was no other, when one and another was the same thing. That means that it's not a new experience, a rediscovery. Just like when you have a sense of, when you hear something that's true, you don't learn something new, you have an experience that you recognize something that's true. So if people can get together in marriage correctly, involves a correct understanding of what the process is and of the intimate side especially, which is difficult again to talk about tonight, try to do it next week, but it's an experience of finding the oneness that was the original state of man. Let's take one step back. I don't know, if your taste isn't mystical, then you could sleep for the next 5 minutes. We get to the more practical side. Pay attention. But if you got back mystically to the stage before this physical stage, then it says that the world was a marriage. That means the unity of the universe, the cosmic reality before the world evolved, right, before the world emerged into revelation, was a state of marriage. But the state of marriage was so intense that there was only oneness. The mystics explain something like this. The being, the essence, the existence that was before the world was created was Hashem. That's what was. There's no oneness like His oneness. The whole foundation of Judaism is that He's one, that He's an indivisible oneness. So the concept is that before He built something that was other than Him, of course there is nothing that's other than Him, the world is also part of His oneness, but it manifests as something that looks like it's not. Before that was, there was only His own oneness. There was no manifestation of His being and then a world outside of Him, an external, superficial, finite world like this. There was only oneness. So the mystics explain that that's the ultimate concept of marriage. That Hashem and what could have been that which was later separated from Him were all one thing. Again, it means that, you have to think carefully, it means that there was a power in that level of creation to separate something that later became the world. Now Monday night is supposed to be a mystical night, so if you knew, you'll excuse us, are we supposed to speak about mysticism on Monday night? There was a force, right, in that oneness which we can't understand at all. There was this oneness which we call Hashem before the creation, the Yud Kei Vav Kei, whatever that name means. There was a koyach, an ability to develop a world. He had an ability, he had a power. How do we know it? Because we see the world now. when he decided to create the world, so he built the world that's so-called outside of him. So he and that ability to separate were one at that time. That was the ultimate image. And then what happened was he created a world, this world that we see outside of him, that was the ultimate divorce. That was the root of the union of divorce, and the world crashed at that time. Many, many mystical sources that say that it happened on Tisha B'Av, the Tisha B'Av before the world was created, the Tisha B'Av in the year before the world, before there was time. In the year when there was only mystical time, on Tisha B'Av, the day of mourning, the day of destruction of the temple, of that date, is when the ultimate divorce occurred, where the world crashed, and resulted in what we have now. If you have any sensitivity to these issues, you'll understand that it's no accident that Tisha B'Av is the day on which the temple was destroyed. The temple is called the bedroom of the world. It's called the place where the intimacy, the two golden cherubim in the Holy of Holies, two golden human forms in the Holy of Holies, that expressed love for each other when our relationship with Hashem was what it should be. And when our relationship wasn't what it should be, they turned to face away from each other. No accident that the Gemara says that the Har HaBayis, where the temple stands, where the Beis HaMikdash stands, it's the place, the Shmaya Va'ara Nashki Adadi. That means the place where heaven and earth kiss each other. That word is not chosen by accident. A kiss is a physical expression of love that's universal for all human beings, even though it may not make any sense physically, but all human beings express a connection that way. That's the place where the spiritual connection is made. That was destroyed in the same force, by the same force that caused the world to be destroyed. The destruction of the world and the source of all pain is the divorce that's referred to by the mystics as the divorce between Hashem and what's called Ishchina. We're not permitted even to discuss this in detail, but in vague hints that are given to us, we understand something like this. It's very dangerous stuff to talk about, but briefly and vaguely, something like this. There are no words to say it safely. So all we can say is what the mystics say, that if you think you understand, then for sure you don't understand. But something like this, that the force that generates creation is called male. If you've got a feminist background, the rest of the evening is going to be a waste for you, because we're going to have to deal with that another time. But the force that generates creation is called male. It's not because the male is favored in any way. It's because the concept of giving begins with the male, and the concept of being able to receive in a creative way, to receive and produce life out of that receiving, is what's called female. Try and come back to that if possible. Therefore, the original source of creation, creativity, is called male. That's called Hashem, whatever that means. And what became the force of creation of the world, what manifested in the world, is what's called the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah is some female manifestation of what his essence is. Very dangerous to start separating unity into non-unity, but something like that. Which means this, that when that reality descended, when that reality became external to his essence, the ultimate pain of the world was born. Because he wasn't one anymore. He was one, and he's always one, he always will be. But in manifestation, in Gilui, what's called Gilui, in what the outside, what the observer can see, he wasn't one anymore. The mystics say the following amazing idea. Why is the Golus so painful? Why is the exile so painful? Why does it have to be with such torture? So we don't have our place. We're not in the holy place where we should be. We don't have the unity. We don't have the manifestation of the divine. But why is it so painful? Why is it so brutal? Why have there been thousands of years of such torture? The mystics say the following thing. Exile there had to be. Golus there had to be. Because exile is the concept of creation. What is exile? That's the concept of we should be in the special place where we belong, and we should be united over there, and we should be in charge, and we're not. We lose control, right? We're in the rest of the world instead of being in Israel. We're governed and ruled by others instead of by ourselves. We're not united in the unity as we should have been, right? And we're not in the place where we should be. That's the three defining characteristics of the exile. The creation had those three characteristics. Instead of being a unity, Hashem manifesting as a unity, he became revealed as divorced. Let's put it that way. Right? A separate power was born in the world, and that power is not where it should be. The power is here, instead of with him. These are all borrowed words. Okay? They don't mean anything like what they seem to be saying. You have to hear in an abstract dimension what these words mean. The mystics say this, that if Adam had been born into such a world and had felt the pain of that separation, there never would have needed to be an exile. If Adam had realized that the fact that a world could be manifest, no matter how beautiful, that the world that he experienced, and it's intense, the world that he experienced wasn't like this, Not, we know that the physical reality that he was invested with was 14 levels higher than this, whatever that means. It means his feet, the lowest part of his physical body, didn't descend anywhere near what this physical reality looks like. So his world was completely different, but it was still a finite world compared to the world that we understand as the world of unity. And had he felt the pain of the fact that that beautiful world still is a world outside of the oneness, he would have fulfilled his obligation of exile for all time, and the world would have been perfected immediately. But he didn't feel enough the pain of that separation. He didn't understand what the divorce meant. And so he had to be given another clue. He had to be put into a place where it's much more painful. And when that wasn't enough of a clue for us, we had to be tortured worse. And we still don't wake up and get the hints. We still don't try and get back to that unity. We still avoid the spiritual option. We still seek externality always. So they have to beat us harder and become more brutal to try and get the message across. And finally it says the message will get so brutal, the torture before the coming of the messianic revelation will be so intense that we'll be forced back to unity. But again, the root of creation is a divorce. Alright, that's just a basic and brief beginning of where some of the concepts of male and female begin and the concept of marriage. There's much more to be said from a mystical point of view, but let's look at something a step more practical. They approach it like this. See that the perfection of being human lies in marriage, and the destruction of this generation is in marriage. What this generation is doing worse, the prostitution of this generation, but in every sense, is in the area of male-female relationships. Everything that should be holy and modest and kept for a spiritual and private purpose has been stripped naked, being sold like horse meat. That this generation is completely insensitive to the hiddenness of what this private area should be. And you see the consequences. So let's understand what is it that's, where's the conflict between Torah values and the secular world's values? Because almost always you'll find that the way the secular world sees a thing, almost always, is exactly the opposite of the way Torah understands things. Almost always reliably, the way the secular world understands the concept is the exact opposite of the way we see it spiritually. Let's try and trace this and follow it and understand it in marriage. This is very practical. The essence of what it means to have a successful marriage is in this point. Okay, let's try and work it out. The idea of being human, the idea of being manifest as human in the creation, is to be given the challenge to take one of two forms. To take the form of being a giver or a taker. That's the way it's put by the famous Rav Dessler. Let's try and understand it from this perspective. You can either be a giver in the world or you can be a taker. If you're a giver, you live spiritually and successfully. If you're a taker, if you take, if you want, instead of wanting to give, then your life is a disaster. And marriage hasn't got a hub at all. Child raising doesn't have a hub at all. Friendships, nothing, begins. That's the hardest thing in the world, to be a giver. To be a giver and not a taker is the hardest thing in the world. Because the closer you get to giving, even if you try sincerely, even if you really try to give, the more efficient you become, the better a giver you become, the better you feel about it, and you get something out of it. So the closer you get to being a giver, the more dangerous and the more potent the vested interest becomes. A coarse, crude taker who grabs from the world is not nearly as much a taker, not nearly as much a taker, as somebody who is such a do-gooder. If you look around, you'll see the people who are motivated to do good, the real do-gooders of the world, they love it. They get a tremendous thrill out of it. They don't suffer. They enjoy it. The ones who enjoy it the most are the ones who suffer to give. The more they suffer, the more they sacrifice to give, the more they really give of themselves, the more they get out of it. So to really give, to give in such a way that you don't get anything at all, is almost impossible in the world. But that's the idea of being human. Let's understand why. In Mitzvah terms, Jewish personality development, character development, self-improvement, working on yourself, they express it like this. The Ramchal says this. He says that when Hashem created man, he created somebody to be able to receive the ultimate goodness. Huh? Hashem himself is the ultimate goodness. To be good means to give. You can't be good if you don't give. You're neutral. If there's no one to give to and you don't give, that's not called being good. Being good means manifesting goodness, giving of your goodness. So that's why he created a human being, to receive that goodness. And he created the being that could receive the ultimate goodness, himself, the divine manifestation. That's what a human being is. A human being is the creature who can receive the ultimate goodness. How do you receive that goodness? By being a giver, not by taking it. When you copy what he is in the world, the mystics express it something like this. Hashem can only give, he can't take. He can't take, he's perfect. You can't add to him in any way. It doesn't have a deficiency that you can fulfill. Therefore, he can only be a giver. Therefore, to copy exactly what he is, which is what a human's supposed to do, you have to be a perfect giver. As soon as you take anything, you disappear from reality. That's what they say. When you take a gift, you have to hear this well, when you accept a gift, in Jewish spiritual terms, you die. You die, literally. When you accept a gift from somebody, you die. It says, if you think I'm exaggerating, Sene matanos yichyeh. The one who hates gifts will live. That's what it says openly in Chazal. If you love gifts, you're dead. If you hate gifts, you're alive. Just understand what this means. Let's just take care of the crass misinterpretation of this statement first. And that is that you have to take. Because many times taking is giving. When a person, if somebody would make an extreme effort to show his respect and honor for you by giving you a gift, right? Somebody who admires you greatly, let's say, brings you a gift. A Talmud brings his Rebbe a gift. A child brings his parent some offering, some work that he's done, some gift. If the parent wants to be frum and say, Senema Thomas Yichi, I don't want that gift because I'm alive if I don't accept it, that's a terrible, terrible action to do. The biggest gift you can give is to accept that gift. The best thing you can do for that person who wants to show his honor for you is to take the gift from him. That's not an act of taking, that's a pure act of giving. For a person who doesn't want to have any benefit from the world or from anybody else, to be forced to take a gift is a sacrifice. You hear the paradox? And therefore, when you accept a gift from somebody who needs to give it to you, you're not taking, you're giving. And most of parenting is like that. And many, many things in marriage are like that. To be a graceful receiver, but for the sake of giving. I have to understand this more deeply. So let's put that out of the way. It doesn't mean you never accept anything, literally. You always often accept things, but only as an act of giving. You never take because you want to take away. We understand that the concept of life is being like God. Being like Hashem. No. The whole concept of Torah is that He teaches us what He is. He teaches us what His manifestation is so that we can copy it. Because when you copy Him, you achieve His attributes. And so you reflect Him. And He's the definition of life. When you start to disresemble Him, when you're not like Him, so then you're not living anymore. That's simple. That's the Jewish definition of life and death. Since Hashem can only give and He can never receive, so the only way you can have spiritual life is to be a giver. Then you're similar to Him. But as soon as He gives and you take, as soon as He gives in the world and you take from the world, so then you're dead. You're a puppet. You're a recipient. You're the created instead of a creator. The only way you can be alive is to manifest creation just like He does. Just like He creates the world, we have to get out there and finish off the creation. He creates the world, but the final act of creation, it leaves to us. That's what it means that you have to do the Ratzon Hashem. When it says that a person has to do the will of God, what does it mean, the will of Hashem? The will of Hashem means you have to make your will His will. What does that mean spiritually? It's a fantastic idea. It means that when Hashem creates the world, it starts with His desire. Desire, we're choosing this example carefully because the essence of marriage lies here. Desire is the foundation of creation. Because the first thing that happens in any process is the desire to do that thing. Before you even think of the details, and certainly before you start to act the thing out, you have the desire to do. So the beginning of any creation is your will, your desire to do it. And then you start making the plans, and then you start carrying out the plans, and you start building the thing. So the creation is something like this. Hashem has a desire. These words again are borrowed in His dimension. But He has a desire. He starts activating that desire, planning a world, starts building a world, first writes the blueprint of the world, the Torah, then manifests, builds the world according to that blueprint, then puts us in the world, and before the world comes to the final purpose that it's supposed to come to, He says to us, here I stop, and you finish off. Which means that if you do in the world what Hashem wants, you complete the circuit. You complete the act of creation. He wants the world to come to a final, beautiful, amazing tachlis. That's what He wants. But He doesn't do that. He just puts the pieces of the puzzle together just enough so you can finish it off. And we can blow the planet apart if we want. If we want, we can do His ratzon and finish off the job for Him and achieve what He wants in the world. Or if we don't want to, we can kill it completely. It's free choices out. So we can destroy the whole thing. We're about to. There's enough power to blow the world apart. Blow the planet apart many times over now. So when a human being chooses to do what Hashem wants, the mystics say that what you're doing is you're copying Him, and you're completing the circuit, which means that you're becoming part of him. Because his, the ultimate expression of what he wants, right, is what starts in his Ratzon and then carries out itself in the world. But he lets you finish off the carrying out, us. So if you do what he wants, you finish off his job. That means you complete the creation. So the only way to do it, of course, is by first wanting what he wants. Because then you reflect him exactly. He wants, carries out, and stops there. You want the same thing and carry out and complete. That's the ultimate marriage. The ultimate marriage. Of course, it means when you do what you want and not what he wants, you die. Because you just step out of reality. You step out of the circuit. The circuit begins with a source of power, comes down into practical manifestation, then you start and you complete the circuit. That's called love. That's called becoming part of Hashem, that his Ratzon is done in the world. If you want not what he wants but what you want, you just step out of the circuit. You become unreal. You step out into unreality. That's the Jewish idea of the creation of the world. Now again, to do what he wants, you have to be a giver. As soon as you turn around, instead of creating the world the way he wants, you turn around and start taking. So that's the most potent way of breaking the circuit. Not only you just step out of line, but you short circuit the circuit. He's giving. He wants you not to take. He wants you to turn around and keep giving. Use only what you get from him, only in order to give further. Only in order to give further. So if you give further, you complete the circuit. But if you turn around and start taking, absorbing instead of producing, so you short circuit the whole creation. Because some of the ways, mystical and Musa, of looking at the concept of giving as opposed to taking. Let's look at it more practically. Let's look at it more practically. That's the root of the idea of why to take is to die and to give is to live. That's the idea. Let's look at it in more practical terms. Love. The total definition of love is giving, not taking. We start now to hear where we conflict with the secular world, the Western world's model of reality. The Western world thinks that love is where you get. You appreciate. You love because you appreciate what you get. When somebody makes you feel good, you love them. The Jewish definition is exactly the opposite. Love is where you give, not where you get. And exactly the opposite of what the secular world thinks. The giving comes first and then the love follows. People think that it's the opposite way around. It works this way. If you give enough to a certain place, you love that place. The Chachamim say like this, Chazal say, that if you have a certain person whom you don't like and you want to like them, start giving. Start working for them. Start doing for them and giving. Give your life to that person, you'll definitely love them. Even if it's a person you didn't like in the beginning. Because where you give is where you love. Mystically, and in Musa terms, it works because where you give is where you are. And because you love yourself, that's the most powerful emotion you have. Your own self-awareness, your consciousness of self. Which means you have to give yourself. You don't give gifts. You don't give superficial externalities. That won't make you love. If you fob off, you buy off this obligation by giving gifts that don't mean anything to you, you'll never love the place where you're giving the gifts. You'll end up despising that place. You have to give yourself. That's not simple. That's not just... But if you give yourself completely, absolutely, completely, then you must love where you go, because that's where you are. You're only there. The Jewish concept of marriage is giving completely. Not just a commitment, a contract. It's a complete giving. Absolutely everything. You save yourself before marriage. Never, you don't give that area, the intimate side of marriage, the commitment, to anybody. That's the Jewish idea. You save that entity, that being, which is yourself, and you give it entirely, once and for all. You give your whole life to somebody else. See how the secular world thinks? It's not fun tonight, it's fun tomorrow night, and next week, who knows what will be next week, and next week. It's not the Jewish idea. The Jewish idea is that when you give yourself to somebody, you give everything. Start to see what the Western world has done to women. The Western system has taken women and battered them into having nothing left. Men are to blame. Women are to blame for having sold out so cheap. The secular system has come to a point now in the West where there's nothing left for marriage. In most cases, there's no reason for men to get married. Most young people that I deal with are many anxious girls. Very, very anxious young women. Because they've been living together with this chap for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. The last case I had some connection with was a girl who lived together with this man for 12 years. They met when they were 18. When she was 30, she mentioned marriage and he disappeared. When he got married, marriage didn't offer him any new privileges than he had already, only new obligations. So he disappeared. a beautiful young girl of 30, she's trying to pick up the pieces now. She understood she was giving herself. She didn't need a contract. She didn't need some formality to understand that she was committing her life to somebody else. But he wanted his freedom. He was prepared to live in that form of relationship until she wanted to clinch it and make it permanent. She wanted him to manifest that commitment. So he disappeared. And women have got themselves into a situation now where they don't have much option. Because if a woman refuses to engage herself in a relationship properly, deeply and intimately, so she won't have any dates. That's how it works these days. So she has to sell herself. That's the way it works. That's what women have allowed themselves to become. And that's what men, of course, women at least do this with pain. Women at least understand the anxiety. Unless you live in Southern California or some other place, you don't know what to say. Most normal Jewish girls understand that there's a pain in that. Men don't think about it at all. And the end of the situation is that she sells herself into a situation where she has nothing left to offer, except commitment, except tying down. That's exactly the opposite of the Jewish concept of marriage. The Jewish concept of marriage is that when two people stand together under the chuppah, if you ever go to your yeshiva wedding, your flesh tingles with excitement at the explosion that's happening. You have two people who never so much as held hands before. No experience of each other at all. They saved up their life, which is a tremendous burst of idealism. It's not just beating one more gorilla, like a Western world tries to encourage you to spend 6 or 8 hours in the gym every day so you actually look like a gorilla as well as think like one. These are two people who saved themselves up as a spiritual being. That means they try to generate something human, something divine, something really transcendent and spiritual. And that tremendous idealism that they fostered in the world, that their whole life has become, they're giving to this individual. They're giving themselves completely to this human being. Not just for tonight, or for maybe for a week, or a couple of years. They're giving everything that's going to come out of them. The infinite side, the generations that will come out of them. Everything is being committed to this individual. That's a tremendous, tremendous emotion. You have only to be present in such a case to see it. You can feel it. But in the secular world, the girl's 29 already, been living together with him for 8 years, 9 years, very anxious about marriage. And finally, if she's lucky, decide to get married because maybe a sense of obligation, maybe one's children, maybe some other factors, and it happens. But it's a very anxious process, a very anxious process. People often say that if you don't have any experience of each other before marriage, how do you know you're compatible? Silly, commit yourself to this person for the rest of your life, a once-off thing, all or nothing. And what happens if 2 days later you find you're not compatible? You never tried it out. You don't know how you function together. There's an obvious answer, shouldn't take more than a minute's thought, is that if you examine the facts, never mind the ideology, it's another story, but if you just look at the facts, you'll see that in the religious context, people who commit themselves in this way, if you live as I have for the last 7, 8 years in Meir Shearim, areas like that in Jerusalem, you see that people get married without any test of compatibility at all. In the most extreme cases, they only meet once before the marriage. But you have to understand how that works. Also, it's a whole different discussion, how that can work. We shouldn't do that, coming from our backgrounds. But people have very little experience of each other, none. They get married, and there's no divorce. The divorce rate in the so-called ultra-Orthodox, the fanatical black world, is very, very, very low. It's climbing, by the way. The divorce rate in the Orthodox world is climbing rapidly, exponentially, but it's still well under 1%. It's still almost unheard of in the religious world. Whereas in the best context in the secular world, it's over 1 in 2. So look at the facts. Here you have people who try marriage with no test of compatibility, and they stay together. And I have worked with these people as a doctor, and I can tell you that they're happy in marriage. I work with them intimately. It's not just that they've got a social stigma attached to divorce that they don't want to. Their marriages are happy. Their marriages are not only happy, they're idealistic. They're idealistically happy, and they get better. Talking about people who work on themselves. But in the secular world, people have every confidence of compatibility. They've been living together for 2 years, and the marriage crashes after 3 months. Many of the divorces that are taking place now are in the first year of marriage. I've been involved with a number of cases of difficulties, some in the first week of marriage, after people live together for 3 years. And very often in the first year or two or three of marriage. I'm not talking about divorce in the 50s. That's another problem. There's another syndrome that we're going through as well, which is people in their 50s and later, where the husband leaves the wife. Or a younger woman usually. That's another problem. Not talking about them. Talking about marriages where there was a thorough test of compatibility for more than a year. And then in the first brief interlude of time, suddenly they're not compatible. So you see, the facts don't back up the idea. What's responsible for the success? What's the idea behind it? Okay, how do you express this giving? Let's look at it. Well, you give is where you love. You know the Hebrew root ahava, the word ahava in Hebrew, the root is hav, to give. The root of the word love is giving. The word actually means that. It actually means giving. This is the secret of why parents always love their children more than the children love the parents. But that's a universal phenomenon. Parents always love their children more than the children love their parents, because that's the direction of giving. The parents given everything to the child, life itself, and a total ongoing commitment that's more important than the life of the parent. So the parent loves the child. But the child who receives, they got a kind of affection out of gratitude and so forth, but not anything like the love of a parent for the child. But Dessler says that, he always tells the story of a family who was separated during the war. Fascinating example. It was a family in Eastern Europe during the Second World War who were in two opposite sides of town when the Germans and the Russians invaded. The one half of the family was evacuated to the German side and the one to the Russian side. The mother was evacuated to one side and the father with the children, and the father with the two-year-old was evacuated to the other side. And there were 4 years spent apart. When they got back, and they were reunited after the war, many years later the mother said that she was never able to love that child as much as the others, because she'd been deprived of 4 years of giving to that child. Amazing experience. The four of the most formative years, the most intense creative giving of a mother to a child, were denied her, and she wasn't ever able to generate the same affection for that child because she was denied giving, not receiving. So the concept again is to be a giver and not a taker. Let's look at one more element of background and then we'll try and discuss some very practical expressions of this in marriage. And that idea is as follows. Again, we'll try and look at it from contrasting the secular model with the Torah model. If you think about it, you'll see that any contract or relationship between people involves rights and obligations. Always. My right is your obligation. Now, for example, you have an obligation not to steal. That's my right to my property. I have a right to hold on to my possessions. That's your obligation not to steal. But that's always how human relations are. There's rights, there's obligations. The problem is this. Which side do you focus on? What do you talk about? What do you look at? Do you look at your rights or do you look at your obligations? If you examine Western culture, you'll see that it only talks about rights. You understand immediately, of course, that your rights are taking, your obligations are giving. Obligation means what I have to do for you, what I have to do, what I have to give you. Rights means what you have to give me, I'm taking from you. Look at Western culture, you'll see the whole Western world is built on rights. That means I'm taking, not I'm giving. The Bill of Rights. One of the greatest expressions of idealism that this century sees, last couple of centuries, is expressed in what's called Bill of Rights, Bills of Rights. That means the citizen has a right to this and a right to that, right? Right to free speech, right to free assembly, right to your possessions. That's the secular concept of successful human relations. That's exactly the opposite. Exactly the opposite of the Torah concept. So here as well. Society will be happy, they say, if you ensure everybody's rights. What happens when you do that? You have war. You have war. The worker wants his rights. So let the workers, how do they get their rights? They're too weak to get their rights, so they unite. So they can extract their rights. Then what happens? The employers get together. National Association of Employers. And you've got strife, class war, civil war, industrial war. The surest way to battle and to strife and to fragmentation and disharmony is to concentrate on your rights, because that makes you a taker instead of a giver. The Torah never mentions rights. Isn't that amazing? The Torah never says you have a right to your property. It says you're not allowed to steal. That's unique. The Bill of Rights that created the world, the Torah concept of the creation, never mentions what's due to you. Only mentions what you owe him. If you examine it for 2 minutes, you'll see that it's obvious the only way to achieve any form of human happiness is that way. Give you an example. People say this. You know why it's logical for society to focus on its rights? You know why I should worry about my rights? Because if I'm worried about my rights, I'll respect your rights. That's called reciprocity. Why shouldn't you kill? You speak to a social philosopher these days. Ask them, why shouldn't a person kill? They'll tell you, because if I go around killing people, I'll be in danger. Others will do that to me if I start stealing. So then other people steal from me and our society will break down. If you examine that postulate, which is generally accepted in the Western world, you'll see it doesn't make any sense at all. For example, what happens if I can steal when no one will know? So why not? Reciprocity breaks down. No one's going to run out in the streets and start stealing because they see me doing it. If I can do it in secret. So you build a society where, even if you believe in this idea of reciprocity, but if you can get away with it, why not? Right? Take. But if you bring up people with a Torah concept, so they won't take because it's their obligation not to take. Not because they're afraid what will... Even reciprocity is only what you get out of it, so he doesn't do it to me. The whole concept is focused on what you get. The Torah concept is you bring up a child with a sense of responsibility. You bring up a generation. Imagine if everybody out there had an intense sense of responsibility. Never take anybody else. Never hurt. Never say a hurtful word to anybody. So you'd have harmony. You'd have happiness. If everybody was out there giving instead of taking. There's a beautiful Midrash that puts it this way. The Midrash says, Midrash Halacha says this. It says that in Jewish terms, you're allowed to have a slave. Right? That doesn't mean what we think a slave means. The Gemara says that if you have a slave, you have a master, because if there's only one bed, he gets it. If there's only food for one, he eats. So a slave is a very big obligation. Right? But let's not go into that now. The point is, you can have a slave. So the Halacha says this. A person has to treat his slave like a brother. And a slave has to treat his master like a master. Right? In other words, the master has to treat his slave with brotherly love. If there's only food for one, he gives it to him, like a brother. The slave has to work like a slave. He has to worry about the benefit of his master. What happens when they focus on the wrong end of the scale? The master says to the slave, hey, you've got to behave like a slave. You have to behave like a slave. Why aren't you behaving like a slave? And the slave says to him, what are you talking about? You've got to treat me like your brother. So you have a battle. They're both quoting the Torah. They're both quoting Amish. They're both right. They're both 100% right, but they're looking at the wrong end of the issue. The Jewish concept is to look at the right end of the issue. And marriage, therefore, is pure giving. Let's look at some practical expressions of this. Halacha says the following thing. I'm going to look at it more from a man's point of view. Because men usually have more of a problem in this area. Men usually have more of a problem in the Western world. I'm not saying women are blameless over here. Women make plenty of... Women do things that accentuate this problem. But from this dimension that we're speaking now... Next week we'll speak about other dimensions. This dimension that we're speaking in now, often the problem is that men take their wives for granted. They stop giving. They stop consciously giving. They stop manifesting the giving. Sure, if you stop him and ask him if he loves his wife, he'll tell you. Of course he doesn't rush out to buy flowers because it's Friday afternoon. But you have to remind him. Because after the first 2 weeks of marriage, if you're lucky, the first 2 weeks, he starts working on his next million rands or next project. And of course he loves his wife. And of course there's a depth of the relationship. But a man is a creature who always needs a new project. Spiritually, a man, like we said before, the foundation of creativity is what's called male. It's that spark of new generation. Woman is the concept of stability and receiving and giving birth to what she receives. But maleness is the concept of a spark that creates something new. Therefore, a man's nature is not to stay in one place. A man always has a problem of looking at other women. Women very seldom have that problem. A normal kosher Jewish woman. Never, very seldom. It's a very rare ordeal for a woman to be tempted by the promise of a relationship with somebody else. Especially if a marriage is happy. But a man always has that problem. That's why we take such great care in that area. We don't shake hands with women. We're not allowed to look at women for pleasure. You're not allowed to walk behind a woman in the street. The Gemara says that a man is not allowed to walk behind a woman in the street. The Gemara Shabbat says it's better to walk behind a lion because he may not turn around and bite you. That's the Gemara says. Yes, aloha. A Jewish man is not allowed to walk. If you're walking behind a woman in the street, you have to cross the road or run ahead. That's aloha. It's not musa, that's aloha. That's a Jewish obligation. So what hope is there today? He works in an office. You're stuck at home, right? He works in an office where they look like they're about to take a bath, most of them. And the relationship is such that they have to appeal to him, just from an economic point of view. What's a man supposed to do in such a situation? And he's got that problem in his nature already. And his wife isn't a new conquest, a new challenge, so he takes her for granted. The Chazal say that a woman's deepest need is a husband who loves her. And she needs it to be manifested. A Jewish husband has a halacha that he has to not only love his wife more than himself and honor her more than himself, right? As much as more than. He has to show it all the time. And men always forget that. Almost always, unless your husband is a tzaddik, unless your husband really works on himself, well, you know how to remind him. You know how to be exciting, and you know how to be spiritual, and you know how to remind him, like make him think he thought of it himself. Like everything you have to make him think of. That is, men forget. Men forget. Have you ever noticed, why is it that women always want their husbands to say, I love you?
You know, I've been living here for the last 25 years, so why are you in doubt? She wants him to say, men don't have that need. Men think it's men get embarrassed when you, men spit on women, put in that situation. But women have a need for it to be expressed. A dozen red roses can change anything, no matter how bad the disaster, I assure you. A manifestation of that affection is the deepest obligation of a Jewish husband. In the intimate area, you have to explain this, also express this in more detail. The mystics say this, that a woman's deepest need is to receive that from her husband, is to have a husband who loves her and shows it. And a man's deepest need is to give pleasure. Again, we can't speak about this intimately. It's not sure it has to be understood. We have to try and go into it another time. That's a man's deepest need. A man's deepest need is not to get gratification. It's to see it being caused in someone else. Again, we can't speak in more of this. But a woman's need is to be given and manifestly given. The consequence is this. The consequence is this, that the halachas in marriage are as follows. The men are not going to be happy about this, probably. What I can say is that women have to be such that they deserve this. Women have to do this in their own way. But let's focus on it from a man's point of view. It is dangerous to speak this way, I suppose, in front of him. What do we do? You realize, of course, women, that you can't claim this because they're taking. The concept is as follows. A Jewish husband's obligation to his wife is this. He has to love her so intensely that she's the focus of his concentration at all times. He has to show that she is the core and center and totality of his world. He has to show it. Never mind work on himself to the point that he feels something in that. He has to show that all the time. Let's look at some examples. See, women have to do this too, but they usually, a woman who is treated correctly by her husband manifests this. A woman who is treated correctly by her husband manifests this naturally. She doesn't have a problem with it. But a man treated correctly by his wife still takes it for granted. First of all, marriage, when you get married. The first thing is to show, manifest such appreciation that takes the form of giving only, which immediately excludes what the whole Western world is engaged in, which is immediate gratification. Men are only engaged in living this way before marriage because it feels good. It's not out of consideration or love. It's not an act of love. It's not an act of love at all. If it was an act of love, you'd commit his life to it. If you really loved it, love, giving yourself. So give your life. What's this thing of just flowing with whatever happens? That's not responsibility. That's not giving. That's pure taking. We've spoken about that already. In marriage, the concept is only giving. The first 7 days of marriage, there's a Jewish obligation that a husband has to spend every single second with his wife, except for things like, even though the bathroom needs permission. He should be with his wife the shepherd brothers are 7 days when a man has to be together with his wife, intensely, all the time, not disappear at all. The first year, there's a thing called Shana Rishona. What's the idea of Shana Rishona? The concept of the first year in marriage is that the husband's first obligation is manifesting love for his wife, showing her that he loves her, without any break at all. He's not allowed to go to the army if the country's in danger. Right? In Jewish terms, when the Jewish army was being put together, if a man had got married and he was in the first year of marriage and the army needed him, it could be the general, the chief of staff, right? No matter how essential he was, he stayed home. Stay home. It's a vast priority, much more important than defending the country. He has to stay home. He needs his wife's permission to go to work. He needs her permission, and it has to be agreed on before the marriage that she understands and approves and agrees that he'll take a week off, he'll be travelling, he'll be doing something. You're not allowed to do that without permission. Many Mephoshim, many Poskim say that we are so bad at this today that our din of Shana Rishona lasts for 10 years. That means what a woman needs to be manifest, what a husband has to do, a husband has to be so extreme in showing his love for his wife that she's left with no doubt at all that he loves her. It takes a year of intense devotion just to get his wife to the point where she begins to believe that she's the center of his life. And then you could carry on as normal if you're very careful. Most Poskim say that for us, we are so bad at this, it takes us 10 years, and some say it's endless. Because to really manifest that love with the depth of intensity that it's supposed to be, supposed to have, we don't have that skill. And therefore, we never leave off that obligation of showing it intensely. What are the halachas? A man should never be where his wife doesn't know. He should never be at a place where she doesn't know where you are. First of all, it's not their affairs. It's just not common decency to disappear and say, "I should suspect that you're up to something that you shouldn't be." But it's just not kindness, it's not tacit. If he's going to be 10 minutes late, he should phone. If he's going to be unexpectedly late, if he has to go somewhere, he should phone. He should speak, he should tell her. She should always have security, intense security, Of course he has to have the same with her. We're just focusing on the man's obligations tonight. So his luck will focus on the women's. I happen to be a man. She'll focus on the women's obligations. She has to be so secure in the sense of his devotion to her that she never even has an excuse to doubt it. Let's see how far it goes. Martin Post can say the following thing. You see, this is radical for us to hear, because we've been brought up to believe that marriage is a partnership. That's the key word, that's the catch word. You go to any talk on marriage, they tell you it's a partnership. You've got to do this and you've got to do this. You owe me this and I owe you that. Right? What you owe, you're right. Judaism says there's got nothing to do with a partnership. A marriage is not a partnership at all. Not at all a partnership. You're not supposed to. A partnership means I've got my share of duties and you've got yours. You know what the Bala Musa say, that there's a chair in Shemaim, there's a seat in Shemaim that's always empty, and it's called the chair of the happy partner. Because there's no such thing as a satisfied partner. The nature of a partnership is that you always think you're doing your share, how come he isn't doing his? That's the nature, that's the way we look at it. So partnership's out. Partnership, of course it is a partnership in them, but that's not what you're allowed to focus on. Of course she has obligations. Divorce is a consequence of not fulfilling certain of those obligations, and similarly for the man. It's only obligation one to the other. But you're not allowed to think of that. You have to be a giver and not a taker. You're not allowed to demand those your rights, her obligations. Only focus on yours. The Bala Musa say that a person should look at his wife and compare her to what he would have had if she hadn't been prepared to settle for him. That means most men compare their wives to the best that's imaginable. Not to what where they would have been left without this fantastic woman. But I'll give an example. He comes out for supper. And she serves him a blackened sort of piece of something unidentifiable. She gets upset. Gets very upset. That's a natural reaction. Listen, I work hard all day. I slave away in an office. I work really hard. You do nothing at all. You sit at home doing nothing. And, you know, it's just like, because he's comparing her to the Ritz. He's comparing her to what they serve at the best hotel in town. And so it never reached up to his expectations. The Bible must say you have to compare your wife to what you would have had if she hadn't settled for you. You'd be opening a can of peas tonight. That's how you have to think. You have to think of, you're supposed to think of your partner. You're supposed to say to yourself, listen, this person married me, they've got to be a tremendous bloke, hasn't it? This person married, I know who I am, I know what I am. And I know she knows what I am. As I'll say that the one person who knows a man is his wife. He can fool the rest of the world and often does. But a wife, after a few days of being together, as I'll say that a woman knows exactly every detail of husband. It's a very, very rare occasion. There are few cases among the Chazal, among the Chachamim, of people who manage to be greater than what their wives understood. That's very rare. That means the universal reality that a woman is gifted with a special gift of insight into personality. And by the way, that's another halacha in marriage. If a man brings home a friend whom his wife doesn't like, even if she can't say why, he shouldn't relate to that person anymore. That's halacha. The Torah regards a woman as having a depth of sensitivity for personality, even if she can't articulate exactly what it is. And that's usually the case, and so she starts making fun of her. She can't express it, so she thinks she's an idiot also. That's not the way it's supposed to be. If she puts her finger on something that's not right, she has a depth of sensitivity that's given to her as a special gift. He's supposed to respect that. She knows him. She knows him inside out. And knowing that, he knows that she knows what he is, and he knows what he is, and she settled for me. And therefore, you have to compare everything she does. This is how men's your perspective is supposed to be, and a woman too is supposed to think that way. That this person puts up with me, they gave their life to me, they committed everything that they are. Everything that they are, they gave to me. There's no bigger gift than that. What more could you give to somebody? And the emotion has to be what, of such intense appreciation for that gift, that you always know. The person can say this. You shouldn't ask your wife or husband to do you a favor. You shouldn't ask for a favor. You should not ask your wife to pass you something, Chris, unless you're sure that she considers it a privilege. Because otherwise you're taking advantage. That's not what a relationship of respect is. If she's the most important person in the world, you're supposed to focus on her, you're supposed to focus on him, as the most important person in the world. You don't treat the most important person in the world that way. Understand. Let's say the Prime Minister comes to visit you. And he arrives at your house with his old entourage and bodyguards and the whole thing, and he spends an hour on a state visit at your home. As he's leaving the house, you say, Mr. Prime Minister, I know you're going past the drive in, so would you mind just dropping off? Now, you don't do that. Why don't you do that? He's too important. You show too much cover. You show too much respect. Why do you do that to your wife? Why do you do that to your husband? Are you not allowed to ask somebody else? Ask anybody else. Do it yourself. The only time a person is allowed to ask his wife or husband to do a menial favor is if he's quite sure that she considers it an act of intimacy and privilege. You know, in the Nidda laws, in the laws of menstrual separation, where there's no physical contact between husband and wife, you're not even allowed to prepare a drink for each other, because it should be an act of intimacy. She's not allowed to pour in wine. He's not allowed to pour her wine. You're not allowed to run a bath for each other. Why? Are you going to end up in an intimate situation, intimate relationship that's forbidden just because you ran the bath for her, or you sat on her bed? These are all things that are forbidden, by the way. Should be intimate. Should be an exciting experience. It should be. But we're so bludgeoned into insensitivity that we don't understand these things. We don't shake hands with a woman. In the middle situation, you're not allowed to hold hands with your wife. Not even touch. So people say, that's not going to lead to any, you know, holding hands is going to lead to who knows what. Should be dangerous. Should be dangerous. It should be so exciting. People often say, you're so prudish in the religious world. You know, you're not allowed to kiss on Daisy, and you've got a family gathering, you can't kiss this one, you can't kiss is a sign of kiss a woman, and it's a sign of something that's meaningless. You know what a desensitization is? When a person, when a man kisses a woman, there's only two possibilities. Either it has a significance, which is terrible. What are you doing kissing some woman with significance is not your wife? That's definitely forbidden. Or it has no significance. That's worse. To be able to kiss a woman that should have no sensation at all, that's a tremendous loss. But we're exposed to such brutality, to such extremes, that we need such intense thrills to be able to feel anything, that we've lost the art of sensitivity. And that's part of the reason why no wife lives up to her husband's expectations. Because his expectations are the world. No woman can live up to that. What they create artificially and selling, she can't provide. And he's trying to think that that's what he deserves. Give you another example. To what extent does he have to put his wife first and she put him first? Again, I'm just giving men's examples. Probably going to get tortured outside. Send your wife next week. I'll give you an example. The first thing said, this is brought in a certain recent book written to describe the Torah essay, actually a book that was banned by the Bakhtin in the initial line, but it was banned because the second part deals explicitly with the intimate side of marriage, and they felt it shouldn't have been expired. But in the first half, he says this. Let's say a man is sitting at a board meeting, and millions of brains are being discussed. Okay, it's a critical moment. He's in. Got the meeting's adjourned. You can wait for 5 and speak to him. That's a halakhic obligation. Because who's more important? Who's more important to a person? If a million rand is more important, and the responsibility of the whole company is more important than his relationship with his wife, he's a wreck. He's a wreck. That person's life is in a shambles. The person doesn't understand what life is. At the drop of a hat, a man should give up all that. And a woman too. But women usually don't have this problem. Usually women will give all that up without any provocation. But a man needs severe re-educating to be able to see life that way. That's how we are. That's how we've been taught. That's how we've been taught. But it's the opposite of the Jewish way. By the way, if you are a man who controls a massive company, and in the middle of the most critical moment of your board meetings, your wife's fighting, she's doing it for a reason. She's doing it because you don't treat her that way, and she's going to keep fighting. But I guarantee you, most normal women, if you once say loudly, "Gentlemen, the meeting's over, I'm speaking to my wife," she won't phone anymore. A woman manifests, always manifests the desire in some way or other to show a husband that she needs him to express his love for her. And she'll sometimes torture him to get that out of him. She'll torture him, she'll wreck his business, she'll wreck anything. In order to make him show that she's the center of his life. And the more she tries that, the more he hates her. And the more violent he gets, the less he understands. And often, the result is disaster. Let's just make one more comment, and we'll leave it there for tonight. We can't deal with all the practical aspects. We'll try and deal with some in the future meditation, but at least one or two practicalities. Just to pick out one or two. First of all, there's a Jewish concept of division of roles. Okay? There's a Jewish concept of splitting the roles. The husband does certain things and the wife does certain things. They don't have to be the stereotypes. They do not have to be the stereotypes. If you have such a relationship where you want to stay home,
and look after the house, if you want to do that, you as a man, and she's a brain surgeon or a test pilot, it's allowed in jurisprudence. It's absolutely allowed. But it has to be clear, and the lines have to be drawn carefully and clearly, and the responsibility has to be divided. The default position, that means if it isn't stated what the responsibilities are, the Talmud says as follows, that the husband has final say on what's called milidishmaya. Milidishmaya means things that bear directly on spirituality. And the woman has final say in what's called milidara. Milidara means things that bear on the physical reality such a way that they will grow the spiritual reality. The running of the house. Right? The running of the house, what it looks like, all the practical physical reality, unless agreed upon otherwise, right, is the woman's domain. Of course, she has to run it in such a way that what comes out of that home is tremendous happiness and spirituality. It means this. For example, the location of the home, the style, what the house looks like, what color the walls are painted, how it's furnished, right? The Jewish process of dealing with that issue is first of all discussion and consensus. But if you can't reach consensus, she has the say. If the wife wants purple walls with pink spots, he loves it. That's halacha. That's not musa. That's halacha. That's the way it has to be. That's her responsibility. The poskim write that the way the children are dressed is entirely her responsibility. If he doesn't agree at all, that's irrelevant. Right? If you can't achieve consensus and discussion, it's another halacha. Discussion about these things has got very strict rules. The first rule is you're not allowed to talk about anything at the time of disagreement. Okay? That's the Jewish obligation. When she serves the meal that you hate, the particular meal that you detest, you can't stand that food, you're not allowed to say it at the time. You're allowed to say it when she serves the meal that you like. Then you're allowed to say, this is great, this is my thing. You're allowed to say it. And it has to be in love at a moment of affection and a moment when you're very close and when there won't be any hurt at all, you're allowed to talk about it. But at the time when something goes wrong, you're not allowed to talk about it then. Because the pain is too great. Of course, we're not like it. We explode at the moment when the problem arises, and if we manage to control ourselves and don't, usually we forget about it, it doesn't bother us. Usually it only bothers us because we're excited about it at the time. If you think about it 3 days later, it seems so irrelevant. The thing you thought about is so silly and so irrelevant that you don't even bother to bring it up. But if you have to bring it up, and if you know it's something that the next time you're likely to explode about, and usually the points of friction are well defined and they're the same old things. People fight about the same old things for 40, 50 years. The same tiny points, sometimes only one or two tiny things are made a wreck because of it. You have to discuss them at a time when it's not an issue. Only at a time when it's not an issue. So, when you discuss things, you try and sort it out. If you can't, the rules are clearly divided. The food, the home, the clothes, anything to do with the physical reality, she has the final say. Anything to do with the spiritual direction of the home, he has the final say. Now, that's the way it's divided, unless agreed upon differently. That's the system, that's the way it works. So many fights begin in families, marriages, because each one thinks they can do the other one's job better. The husband wanders into the kitchen and makes a helpful comment about what's going on. That's a disaster. Disaster, not allowed. It's not allowed. Or she makes some comment about it. It's not allowed. It's absolutely not allowed. Settle for whatever it is. The boys can say that you should even go to great expense for that. If your wife has a habit of leaving the lights on. But you know how many families are rocked, because she happens to be jealous about leaving the lights on. And he goes crazy about the expense and the irresponsibility and all. The first team says, spend the money. What's the difference? Calculate what it will cost you for the next 50 years of leaving the bathroom light on. What will it cost? How many tubes of toothpaste will be wasted if she doesn't close it the way you like to squeeze it? It's worth the expense. It's minor expense. It's worth major expense. But usually these are minor expenses. Money. How the money is handled. The first team says it's a neutral area. It doesn't fall into either one's responsibility, but it must be carefully decided. Some husbands, in Torah terms, give their wives an allowance, if it's the man or the breadwinner. She has an allowance, and it's firmly agreed that she can work within that allowance. In many families, the wife handles the finances. In many Torah homes, where the husband's learning, the wife handles all the finances. But once you've agreed on how it will be done, you have to stick to that. You can't intrude. And if it's not being done correctly, too bad. Once you agree to that, you have to put up with the fact that they won't do it the way you want. And if you do want to correct it, can't be at the time when a mistake's being made, no matter how expensive the mistake. You settle for that. That's what you want. If it's decided differently, then you have to bite your tongue and keep quiet and do it that way. One final point in connection with this. And we'll leave it with this. And that's as follows. let's just take one last swing at Western culture. Rick teaches that the only way to be healthy psychologically is to let it all out. Let out your emotions. Let it all out. Unhealthy to bottle it up. It's unhealthy to bottle it up. Tell me what you think of it. You get sick otherwise. The Torah idea of self-development is not is to bottle it up. To conquer it. Not to bottle it up so that it eats away at you, but to conquer it so it isn't there anymore. Think for a moment. Think carefully. What does Western psychology say? Western psychology says this. If you bottle up anger, you'll get sick. You'll get an ulcer. You'll get all kinds of illnesses if you bottle it up. It'll eat away at you. Therefore, express it. But 2 minutes later in the same textbook, any textbook of psychology, you'll see they say that if you express a thing, you train yourself to be that thing. That's called conditioning. If you walk around letting it all out, you train yourself to be that way. And by the way, in spiritual terms, it goes much deeper than that. Because the mystical concept is that when you do a thing on the outside, it creates an internality like that. That's called ahitsonius moreretis atnimius. The external action awakens, like when you give, you love. That's what we said before. It's not that you decide to love. You can't decide to love and then start giving because you generated the love. You first give and it causes you to love, like we tried to explain before. The Jewish concept is that your actions cause you to be what you are. If you control anger perfectly outside, you won't feel anger. You'll get to a stage where it doesn't begin. Because when you control the manifestation, you control the emotion. It's almost the same thing. Not quite, but almost the same thing. It's a natural, inevitable consequence. But the world says exactly the opposite. The world says, no, express it all. If you think for a moment, you'll see. Who's the person who gets sick with anger? Who's the person who gets sick? The one who expresses it all? There's a man driving down the main road, screaming, cursing, shouting, hooting at everybody. They're letting it all out very efficiently. Plenty of ulcers. Those people are very sick. There's a man who never expresses a word of anger. Some Tibetan monk, maybe, I don't know, sitting in bed. Nobody else's. It's not letting it out, that's healthy. It's controlling it at its core, that's healthy. And therefore, the bottom line in marriage, in giving, is infinite and ultimate respect. You never express anything negative. Once you said a hurtful word, you can never take it back. If you show anything less than the most ultimate, tremendous respect, you've let it out. You've let out the secret. You've let out the secret. You've damaged, you've fractured that relationship. In a moment of anger, you said something disparaging. And usually you say something so personal, so hurtful, because you know the person so well, that they'll never leave. That scar will never leave. The first rule is to show such, not even in a joke, in Torah homes. You'd never make a joke. In the West, it's considered the butt, not the normal, the real slick social wit. Not is to parry, you know, with each other, you know, in insulting terms. And sometimes very, very biting. Of course, it's all in fun. In front of other people. It's a very, very distasteful thing. Very distasteful. Tremendously distasteful thing. In Jewish terms, that's out completely. You manifest ultimate respect always, in privacy and with others, especially with others. Tremendous respect. Never say anything even likely that could even be taken as something derogatory. When something needs correction, you have to know how to do it. You have to very, very, very delicately know how to correct something that needs correcting. But you can't say it. You can't say it. There are marriages that have been wrecked because 30 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, somebody made a biting comment in order to let it out. So they let it out, and the marriage died. That's not allowed. The Bible must say that if you want to know how this is possible, how is this possible? You could live like that. You could live intimately with somebody. The most intimate moments when your control, your guard is down, when you're not feeling well, when everything's going wrong, and show tremendous respect. That's not possible. That's superhuman. The voice came say, stop talking and think carefully. How did you behave before you got married? How did you behave with this person? Like in the courtship. How did you behave in the weeks or months of courtship? Said anything insulting? Said anything biting about her mother? You insult. You were oozing charm. Huh? That's how it was. Before you even had a possibility of seeing her, let's say, you'd make sure your hair was cut. I mean, these days are. People don't take care of their appearance. It's part of the disintegration of this generation. But you took care about your image. Huh? You were all conscious of your image at every moment. Women, by the way, often remain conscious of their image throughout life. But men just completely drop it. They completely forget about it. It's not the smell. A person has to generate the consciousness, and it's all hard work. It's not easy. It doesn't come naturally. On the contrary, it's very unnatural. But a person has to always ask themselves, how would I have behaved on my first visit, like the first date, and I'm trying to make a good impression? The first time I met this person. The way you act the first time you meet somebody is you act. You put on an act. You don't show yourself the way you are. You don't dare. You put on an act. The Bala Musa say that the whole of life is one big act. That's the way to achieve spiritual living. To pretend that you're there. Pretend you're one step ahead of where you are. Pretend you've got 1 degree more self-control than you really think you have, and you'll have that degree. Pretend that you can do kindness. Say a gentle, kind, sensitive word. That little bit more than you really feel you can, and you'll be doing it. Keep pretending in front of children. Pretend all the time. Pretend in front of children all the time that you're in total control. Absolute and total control. Total dignity and total control all the time. It's an act, it's a performance. You close the door, you go through and punch the wall. It's fine. But in front of the children, it's an act. And you get there. And marriage is one big act. An act that has to be exactly like the courtship was. You're not supposed to discuss anything distasteful. People discuss sometimes bodily functions. People of Das Torah say it's not correct, it's not good, unless it's a real need or there's an illness or something like that. But otherwise, it's not. Intimacy doesn't mean that. Intimacy doesn't mean expecting the other person to wallow in things that are distasteful. That's not the way it should be. The person should be treated and seen to be treated all the time with tremendous respect and admiration. Let's leave it there.